Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first press conference of the cycling podcast on the Tour de France. Questions in French and English only, questions en français et en anglais uniquement. No questions will be taken on the Anglo-French relationship.
Thank you, Francois, for opening tonight's press conference. Sadly, this is our first one of the Tour de France. We got stuck last week traveling, and so we weren't able to record this, but we did this at the Giro. We're doing it again here. We're taking the questions that you have phoned in. You've left messages on our WhatsApp number. We've got lots to get through, so let's just crack on, shall we?
Hi, chaps. I know I'm late to the party, and you may not be able to answer my question today. But as someone who has taken years to try and get the optimal position on my bike, and that has ridden the majority of the Paris-Roubaix route, I know the consequences if the bike is not quite set up for you correctly. I find it absolutely amazing to hear in your post-Parve stage roundup that teams will have up to 5 bikes set up for the team leader in case of mechanicals. If this is the case, how on earth do these poor domestiques cope with a stage like that with a bike that doesn't quite fit them properly?
Well, that was Bryn with a question from the Pave stage. Seems like a long time ago now. It's a good question, actually, because there was a lot of that going on the cobbled stage. And, you know, I guess riders are matched for bike changes. I'm thinking Rigoberto Urán, Dani Martínez on another stage where the bikes are pretty similar in terms of size. But it is dangerous when riders change to a bike that's not quite the right size for them. I mean, going way back to 1983, I remember Bernard Hinault in the Vuelta rode with his saddle at not quite the right height and did his knee quite bad damage. So when the body is very tuned to a certain position, it can be not great. But different riders adapt differently to those changes. There's a famous story about Geraint Thomas, who's in the yellow jersey here, of course, finishing a stage on someone else's bike and not realizing, because he's quite adaptable. But yeah, nice comments about you there, Francois, as well, from Bryn.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the thing is, I don't have to change bikes personally during the during the tour, because I'm sitting at the back of the car in the nest and very rarely goes front. So I'm quite, you know, adjusted to my seat, and even on the cobbles, I feel
you're fine on the cobbles.
I think the sort of short answer to that is that on a stage like that, or indeed in the mountains, the team leader is the queen bee, and the other bees in the hive do whatever is required for the queen bee, and if that means riding some kilometres on a bike that doesn't quite fit them for until they can get a full bike change, then that's what happens. I mean, you know, these things, this is a kind of, particularly on the cobbled stage, the kind of craziness and the sorting out those logistics on the hoof, it was absolutely incredible to witness. Mm. When I was standing out on the pave, cars were stopping everywhere and riders were swapping bikes and getting wheels and stuff. It's just part of the race. I mean, they're often not riding in ideal circumstances, either the wrong bike or they've got a niggle or whatever. That's just the tour.
There was an interesting remark from the Edges to Our guys. I remember on one of the stages, I don't think it was in the cobbles, it was one of the Brittany stages, when Romain Bardet had to change bikes, and he took another bike and he lost a little bit of time there. And actually, what I was told was that actually the plan was that, you know, another teammate was supposed to stay with him to change bikes, and another teammate was supposed to stay with Pierre Latour to give him his bike in case of trouble. But it didn't happen that way, because that's the plan you make at the start. But I mean, in the turmoil of the race, I mean, sometimes it doesn't happen, so you take whichever bike gets to you. And and about the teammate, well, you know, he's only asked to finish the stage within the time cut, and that's it.
Hi guys, this is Kieran calling from Llangollen, North Wales. My question is about TV coverage. I was watching an old Lance video back from 2001. I know, shame on me. And one thing I noticed was that the TV coverage, in its essence, in terms of graphics and information, was pretty much the same as it was today. And if you compare that with football, for example, which has all sorts of clever graphics and information, particularly at halftime, I feel that the TV coverage of the Tour and cycling in general could give so much more information than it does. Just two examples, I'm sure you can think of more. One, when they're on climbs, can we not see the incline? can we not see, because it's very hard to see from TV, are they on a 6%? Are they on a 15%? Surely that's not too hard. And the other suggestion is sprint finishes. You can't see anything with a camera shooting face on to the sprinters. You can't tell what position they're in. What about a split screen with an overhead shot? Okay, that's just two of my suggestions. Keep up the great work. Loving it so far. Cheers.
Yeah, I take the point. I think that there was a lot of excitement maybe 2 or 3 years ago about the fact that data was coming. We were going to see how fast individual riders were going and what heart rate and what power output and so on. But I think we've kind of realised that the information just shown barely on the screen, it lacks context, really. And sometimes it can be quite sort of random, the stuff that they see. I mean, the one that always sticks in my mind is when, you know, the brake is on the climb and it says they're going at 16 kilometres an hour and the bunch is in the valley and they're going at 55 kilometres an hour. And it's like, well, what's that really telling us? It tells us that they go a lot quicker on the flat than they do on the climb. So I think the sort of selection of that data is one thing. I can't remember which sports director it was now who told me in the week that relying on the data that you get on the TV for your race tactics is absolutely pointless, because even with 4G or whatever, you can be on a 2-3 minute lag. So, the data that's on the screen, how accurate really is it? You know, what is it we're actually seeing?
So you can say to a rider, attack, and he says, I attacked 2 minutes ago.
Exactly, yeah. I mean...
I talked to Neil Stevens on the World Tour a couple of years back, and he was saying, and I was telling him, what do you tell the your riders in the climbs, and when did you tell them to attack? He says, I don't say anything. I said, why is that? Because by the time I tell them something, they've done it already, you know? Mm. So, yeah, as you say, I mean, there's been this attempt. I remember, I mean, all sorts of companies have been trying to put data, I'm not going to cite anyone I don't want to make, but I, covering the Quebec and Montreal Grand Prix every year, I mean, the guys in charge of this were also coming for Formula One, were also trying to put data. But what's interesting in the end, there's another very interesting thing. You might ask yourself, because that would be the most important data, is how come... we don't know who precisely, we were mentioning sprints, who is at, you know, where at any given moment during the race. How come they don't have like GPS chips, you know, on their bikes or their jersey, and then with satellites you could know it precisely where every rider is?
But this is the thing, the technology, it's not precise enough. When you have on your phone a GPS location, it says accurate to 24 meters, and you think,
that's right,
pretty good if you're trying to find someone in a bar. But if you're in the peloton, I mean, that's absolutely pointless.
That's the answer. I mean, the answer is when a bunch sprints. And you might think, well, it should be simple. Everybody's got a GPS position, so we know exactly who won, who was second and third. It doesn't work like this, because there's interferences between the chips. That tried that before. It just doesn't work. So maybe it'll be more relevant in 10 years' time, but not
yet. Kieran makes a very good point about the TV coverage not changing over time. Mm. And that is a problem. And I just think it's a question of the size of the audience. I think if the cycling audience was significantly bigger, and TV companies like Sky or somebody else was prepared to invest a lot of money in it, it would probably change. Like, you know, in football, you've got player cam and so on. Difficult to do that in cycling. And there are limitations, obviously, of a moving thing happening on an open road.
I take the point about the sprint finishes. You know, it is sometimes difficult depending on the angle of the camera, and an overhead would be fantastic. And of course, you get the overhead shot afterwards. I'm not quite sure why you don't get that.
One, at some point, you know, drones flying over the peloton and picking out individual riders.
The problem is, as far as I know, is you can't have a moving camera on top of the last 200 meters moving like you have in tennis or wherever, because it would be much too expensive to set up. You actually have a camera standing on top of the.
On a big arm.
But it just moves. The problem is the production of the tour coverage is probably cost 10 times as much as covering a football match, because you're moving all the time over 250 km with motorcycles. You need a you need two planes as relays. You need helicopters, and the only way to shoot a sprint from, you know, from the 500 meters to the finish would be a helicopter. But the riders wouldn't accept that because helicopters disturb the race, you know, if they're too close. So I'm not saying it's unfeasible. I'm saying it would be very costly and very heavy in terms of logistics.
In a few years ago, the innovation of having the side on camera on the Champs-Élysées sprint, that kind of, it was kind of interesting, but oddly you see less of the actual sprint from that side on angle than you do if you can see the whole width of the road. But as you say, Francois, it's the cost of covering a day on the Tour de France with the helicopters or the motorbikes. I mean, it must, well, I could get this wrong here, but I gather that a day's coverage of the Tour of Britain costs just under £250,000.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm going to sound very snobbish about it, but I read an interview by Godard, the film director, you know, very famous film director, who was a great football fan, and he was asked, how would you film football if you had the chance? He said, oh, very simple, one camera, you know, from where I'm standing in the stands, and I'll see it exactly how the spectators in the tribunes do see it. So,
yeah. That figure from a TV insider, I'm quite happy to be contradicted on this, but with planes, motorbikes, helicopters, what have you, all of the outside broadcast stuff and you know, staff and so on, you for the Tour of Britain, you'd be talking £250,000. Extraordinary cost of covering a bike race.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Hi, it's Fleck from Rafa. At Rafa, we believe that cycling transforms lives and that cycling is the answer to many of our daily problems and challenges. For me, it gives me the headspace to think about the people dearest to me and focus on the most important things in life. It's amazing where your mind goes when you give it time to wander. We have 23 Rafa clubhouses around the world with 300 rides a week with thousands of people. So wherever you are, we invite you to ride with us. Head to rafa.cc to find a ride near you.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor. We're very grateful to them for their support. And you can follow the Tour de France, as you heard there, by riding your bike with Rafa or going to one of their clubhouses around the world to watch the Tour de France. They have also produced, I think, one or two editions of Race Radio, their video series. Lionel, I think you met the people from Race Radio on Alpe d'Huez, did you not?
I did. They were on Dutch Corner, as was I. I left before the race actually came past, but I think they were staying to film the race or be there when the race came past.
So you'll find that on YouTube or at rafa.cc. Let's plough on with our next question. This is from Joe.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is Joe from London here. Keep up the good work out in France. Really enjoying the daily podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the behaviour from some of the fans roadside, directed towards Chris Froome and Team Sky. I appreciate I'm probably slightly biased here, being a Brit and a Team Sky fan. I find it slightly hypocritical that they boo, they push and they throw liquid at Chris Froome and Team Sky, despite the fact he's now been proven innocent. Yet riders such as Alejandro Valverde, that have received doping bans in the past, get away unscathed. What do you think about this hypocrisy, and do you think Team Sky get a rough ride? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. One for Francois there, I think.
It's a very tricky one. I mean, you know, the hostility of the public on the Tour de France has always been a part of the tour. You know, the boos have been part of the tour since 1904. I mean, in 1904, actually, guys from Nîmes, I remember,
which Alejandro Valverde was right there.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, 1904. I mean, guys stopped the race and shot guns, you know, at the riders, because the local rider, a guy named Payan, he had been, you know, disqualified by the organizers. So they were, you know, the local fans in Nîmes, they were not happy about that, and they, you know, they stopped some of the riders and beat them up. So I mean, you know, it's part of the Tour de France tradition. It's nothing new. I remember Eddie Merckx was punched in the face. I mean, there's always been it's inevitable in a race that's so close, in a sporting event that's so close to the actors of the thing, that there might be problems. But why Team Sky and not the others? First of all, because they win. Because remember, the public on the side of the road, usually what they want is actually they want they want a kind of tense, very disputed contest. They don't like it when it seems easy. So when you have someone like Eddie Merckx or Lance Armstrong in the day, and now Team Sky, dominating too outrageously, they feel cheated in a way. So that's one of the reasons. Obviously, one of the other reasons, that there's always been an old Anglo-French feud. I mean, I'm thinking rugby there or other sports, so that it adds to the thing. And of course, the doping allegations that have been around for a long time now. If you put them all together, why is not Alejandro Valverde booed on the side of the road? Because he's not leading the tour. He's never won it, and he'll never win it. So if you add the winning factor, the Anglo-French feud, the doping allegations, and this tradition of Tour de France hostility towards the actors, I think you get quite a fair answer to your question.
Hi chaps, this is Joe from Aylesbury, UK. I'm wondering what do you think of Mikel Landa's chances this year at the Tour?
Thank you, Joe, for that question. Mikel Landa, well, we were all very curious how Mikel Landa would get on moving teams and not. There was a feeling last year at the Tour that we weren't seeing the best of Mikel Landa because he was riding for Team Sky. But it's interesting, isn't it, when somebody has the opportunity to fly on their own. And I'm thinking there of Jean-Francois Bernard, who used that very sort of metaphor to describe how he felt when Bernardino retired and he had the opportunity to lead a team, and it was difficult. Now, Mikel Landa isn't really leading his team here, although you could argue that he is now because he's the best placed of the three Movistar riders. And it isn't so easy. I feel that in this final week, we will see a better Mikel Landa than we've seen so far, because I think the crash that he had on the Roubaix stage was heavy. He will have been hurt there, and I think he's been recovering from that. But whether we'll see the Mikel Landa that we thought we might have seen last year at the Tour this year, I really don't know.
No, well, going into the Pyrenees, obviously he's going to be looking to try and win a stage or gain some time, but it's a long, it's a big gap between him and the Team Sky riders who are first and second. So I think probably podium is about the best he could hope for now, or a stage win. And that's even a stage win is going to be tricky, because he'll have to win a stage out of the GC group, most likely, because they're not going to let him go up the road.
In terms of career, I mean, Mikel Landa might seem to have made the wrong choices. You know, he was with Astana, he was in contention with other riders at the time, Jakob Fuglsang and others. And that, he went to Team Sky. It was the most powerful team in the world, but he was number three or four in the team, so, you know, not good enough. Then he went to Movistar, and once again, they're three leaders there. But it's kind of an impossible task to find the right team for him, because if you want to win the Tour or win a Grand Tour, you must be in one of the best and the most strongest teams. But but if you do, you're bound to have a rival GC leader in the team as well. So what's the solution? I'm not sure Mikel Landa will ever find it.
What music do you actually play in the cycling podcast team car? I'm guessing Amaretera and 13 Senses figure strongly, but is there room for other groups or singers? And is it only wall to wall Taylor Swift and Beyonce when Daniel's with you? It's Beth from Cambridge.
Well, Radio Richard often plays in the cycling podcast car, and I do pull his leg about this, but I'm quite happy with that. It's quite mellow stuff, isn't it? What have we had this last few days? Wild Beasts and Sigur Rós and Midlake. Any kind of wailing female vocalist? Really?
We spent a whole tour playing Jana Newsom a few years ago when I was travelling with Daniel Freeb as well.
Yeah, well, I went home and then got all of Joanna Newsom's stuff on Spotify or whatever. I mean, maybe even purchased it. I don't know. It was a few years ago now. And it just didn't sound the same at home. I don't think I ever listened to it at home. It was just something that became synonymous with the Tour de France. But we listen to quite a few podcasts as well, don't we?
We do. No cycling ones, though, really. We don't really listen to the cycling ones. We listen to the controversial Lance Armstrong a couple of times.
Yeah.
But Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Radio Lab, is one that I like a lot. There's loads of good ones out there.
We listen to a bit of ESPN's 30 for 30 as well, didn't
we? Yes, yes. I always feel we should be, you know, asking Francois what he wants to listen to, because Francois is the real musician among us.
The thing is, my tastes are so varied that, you know, in a way, I like most of, you know, I have, you know, more or less the same taste as you have, Richard, in a way. But I it's funny because I made my, I'm pulling your leg a little bit there, but I made the reflection to myself the other day is what you're listening to is very 40-year-old white male music, because I'm into soul music and R&B and you know, black music a lot, and we very rarely hear black music.
I've been
accused
of having quite narrow taste.
Tortured students music, I think.
Yeah, I'm really moved on, have I?
Yeah, tortured art students music.
We've had a lot
music.
Of Bell and Sebastian. I find Bell and Sebastian
quite
jaunty.
Yeah, great band.
You know, they were playing in Lyon the night before Alpe d'Huez stage, Bell and Sebastian, and by a weird set of circumstances, I got to know Chris Geddes, their keyboard player, who's a very keen cyclist and very into cycling. And when I heard they were playing in Lyon, I sent him an email inviting him into our car for Alpe d'Huez. Unfortunately, they were heading off to Spain for a festival, so they couldn't do it. But he's a very nice chap and very follows cycling very closely. And yeah. they're a fantastic
and
band.
They very rarely play France. And I was telling you before the start of the tour, I never managed to catch Bell and Sebastian because they don't play France that often. And when they come to France during the Tour de France, what a shame.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. This is Thomas. Thanks for all you do. I have a question about the jerseys. I believe the UCI allows only four, but what if there was one more? What would you like to see it awarded for? Personally, I'd like to see something like a jersey for the highest GC in a non-World Tour team, or maybe a jersey for time in the break. Cheers.
I really like the idea of a jersey for the rider who spent the most time off the front in a break. It might create a bit more desire from teams to get in the breaks, because at the moment we're kind of stuck in this pattern. The first 9 days of the race, really, we saw the same three, maybe four teams going the break. And then the middle phase of the race, we see these huge breaks go. It would be good if there was something up for grabs.
But Thomas, there is another jersey up for grabs. There is another jersey, which has become, I would say, as coveted as any of the other ones.
The Pedaleur de Charme.
Yes.
Yeah, well, of course. Not quite official, though, is it? Not quite official. But something, maybe best French rider. Francois. Francois.
They've got that already. It's called the French champion.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that exists already. So, yeah, I was about to say Pedaleur de Charme as well. That does exist. And it fulfills its duty quite nicely, I guess. But, yeah, but what's for sure, I mean, if we don't want to change the rules, the UCI rules, there must be a way to reward breakaways and escapees for sure. And, they should do something about it. That it's very strange, the team classification, for instance. I mean, the teams look very keen on, you know, on being top of that and fighting for that. But for the general public, it's one of the classifications that nobody really cares about. So, I don't know, maybe we could strip, you know, the teams from there. Well, they don't have a jersey, actually, but to you know, to mark that. And maybe, you know, change that classification to something else. I don't know.
Hi, guys. It's Michael Thompson here from Johannesburg in South Africa. But one thing that really struck me was the number of boos and jeers from the crowd against Team Sky. I wonder at what point will a critical mass be achieved where Sky really thinks that it's no longer worth their while to sponsor the team because of all the negative publicity. I mean, at the end of the day, sponsorship really is about publicity to a large extent. And if you're getting such negative press and negative sentiment in the public, I don't know how good it is for your brand. It does worry me, and it's possibly a topic for conversation at some point. It is. I don't know how long their contract lasts for sponsorship with Sky Team, etc. But yeah, anyway, thanks for the great work. Cheers.
This is something I thought about today, actually. We went to the Team Sky press conference this morning, a pretty shambolic affair, which wasn't entirely due to Team Sky. You know, they were staying in a Campanile hotel on the edge of Carcassonne. There was a small area set up for a press conference. There were loud lorries nearby doing all kinds of stuff. I'm not sure what, but they were doing it loudly.
No microphones for speakers.
For you know, Dave Brailsford initially, and then Chris Freeman and Geraint Thomas. And there were far more people there than there would have been had the Gianni Moscon event not happened the night before. So I think that probably swelled the number of journalists and media there. There were also members of the public there getting in the way a little bit, and you know, they should be accredited people only in that space, because journalists are there to listen to the press conference, and it's kind of important that they hear what's being said. So it was, and I looked at it and I thought, this is, you know, this is a multi-million pound sponsorship behind this team, and it just, you wouldn't have that in another sport. Now, cycling is a unique sport, the way that it's run, and the fact that riders have to stay in hotels like that and so on, and there aren't always the facilities for a perfect press conference. But, you know, and I thought about it also in connection to the Gianni Moscon affair, because he's been thrown off the race for, you know, swinging a punch at another rider. And that sort of publicity as well, I think, is as much as the other hostility towards Team Sky, is the sort of thing that a sponsor must look at and go, we don't want an association with that, you know. And you know, and I the handling of Gianni Moscon, the fact that here we are, you know, he's a young rider, but that's about four offences now on the charge sheet, and you think there's a failure of management there, because here's a guy who's been brought to the Tour to do a very important job, his first Tour de France, he's let himself down. It sounds like a cliche, he's let his team down, but that's the sort of act that I think endangers a sponsorship as much as you know, anything else. Now, obviously, an organised systematic doping programme, if that was revealed, a sponsor would run a mile from that. Team Sky have been able to, whether you agree with it or not, they've been able to rationalise all the suspicion, the allegations, and explain them away to their satisfaction anyway. Mm. And be confident that the team is riding clean and that they're producing results honestly. They're confident in that, or they wouldn't still be backing the team. But things like the Moscon affair, I think, are a different sort of threat and a thing that a sponsor doesn't really want to be associated with.
Well, yeah, but I also think the company and the teams have the same mentality, and that is that victory is what counts. Being dominant, winning. You know, Sky as an organisation are exactly like that. You know, you can't. I know Rupert Murdoch is not, you know, is not as involved, but I mean, you know, the DNA of the Murdoch business empire runs through everything that they do, and I think if they win, pretty much anything else gets excused. I think the biggest danger, biggest damage rather, in terms of kind of PR while the Tour de France is still going on, is more or less everything Dave Brailsford said in that press conference, because it was pouring oil on, if not flames, then oil on coal, certainly. You know, turning this into a Team Sky versus the French, it's so lame. I mean, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny. It's not smart. It's pretty reductive. I don't know what's going through his mind there. If he's thinking, I'll draw away the fire from this potential two-man battle between Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome, he did it in possibly the worst way he could have done. I just think it wasn't as clever as perhaps he... Maybe he does think that was a clever strategy.
Let's not forget one thing. Sky... but nobody in France watches Sky. There's no French attention at all to Sky. Nobody in France knows really what Sky is. I mean, you know, it's an English, it's a British, TV network. And the only people watching Sky in France are British expats. So, I mean, the boos from the French public have no negative effect whatsoever on Team Sky as a company, because, the guys who boo Sky don't have a clue what Sky is. And secondly, that's a very interesting thing. We hear these boos and, wow, the hostility of the French public. public, but in the media for the past year, you know, I was reading the British press and the English press about Team Sky. Almost every week you had revelations and, you know, scandals and questions being asked. There was nothing at all in the French press. Nobody cared about the TUI stories and the Jiffy. But ask a guy in the Tour de France crowd about the Jiffy Bradley Wiggins Jiffy bag. I think 1% maybe of the diehard fans of cycling would know what you're talking about. So it's very strange. I mean, I think that for the image of Team Sky, those stories are more damaging for the sponsor than the booze on the Tour de France.
I think the booze on the Tour de France are more to do with the Chris Froome Salbutamol case, which was concluded not to everybody's satisfaction before the tour. I think that's a case that people think that they understand, even if they only have a casual knowledge. I mean, I mentioned this earlier, but we stayed with friends of yours the other night, Francois, who are not diehard cycling fans, and they had absorbed enough from the media to understand that there was this case against Chris Froome, and there's, you know, no smoke without fire, etc., etc. You know, that's what you hear. I think Dave Brailsford made a big mistake this morning, as he did in his criticism of David Lapartien. He drew this caricature of him as a small town French mayor, when actually what he should have done was be very specific in his complaints about David Lapartien and the way that he'd handled that case and some of the things he'd said once the case had been resolved. And it's similarly here. Rather than, you know, paint a whole country as being at fault, be specific. You know, if ASO have failed in their duty as he thinks it, say so. Say exactly what they've done. If the UCI have failed in their duty to protect an athlete who has been cleared of doping, and actually there never was a doping case against him, then say that. Be specific. And I think there is a case to be made that in their actions on the eve of the tour, ASO to have Chris Froome, you know, barred from riding the tour when they knew that the case was about to be resolved. And in Lapartien, in some of the things that Lapartien said once the case had been closed, I think those are legitimate complaints that Dave Brailsford could make.
Especially as this kind of chimes back to the Lance Armstrong tactic of making it against, you know, about American versus the French. I mean, Armstrong's 7-year reign at the Tour de France spanned quite a tricky time for French American relations, because obviously there was the September the 11th attack on New York in 2001, and then the invasion of Iraq, and the French were kind of on the other, they were exercising caution in terms of military action, and the Americans called
freedom fries.
Wanted to call them freedom fries into the French fries. They called the French cheese-eating surrender monkeys. Francois, you must remember. And Armstrong kind of tapped into that, and it made them unpopular 2002 and 2003.
Maybe in a way, Dave Brailsford's comments are actually very good PR for Team Sky, because frog bashing has always been a way to, you know, put the frog bashing headline in a tabloid newspaper and you sell the copy, you know.
No, so frog bashing on the cycling podcast.
No, never. But it's so reductive, isn't it? Especially with Brexit going on and everything. It's like,
from Dave Brailsford disappointment, because he is a Francophile. Yeah. You know, he actually loves this country and he speaks very good French and his father lives here. And so, and we're all doing it. We all love cycling because we love the Tour de France. You know, nobody loves cycling and doesn't love the Tour de France. It's everybody's entry into the sport. So,
to actually say, well, you could have a Tour de France just for French teams. I'd love ASO to say, yeah, okay, great. Next year, you're barred. I mean, you know, if you're going to make that ridiculous claim, well, let's have it returned back with some interest, because then learn the consequences of words in these kind of situations, instead of just a glib kind of throwaway line that's going to get a load of coverage.
Maybe you were right. Maybe the intention was to make tomorrow's stories about that rather than about Geraint Thomas and Chris
Froome.
Yeah,
but Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome are the riders who've got to ride over all the Pyrenean climbs in front of not just French fans. And this is the other thing. They were booing plenty on Dutch corner. It's not just the French.
It's an international
thing. Everyone hates them.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off your Science in Sport stuff at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Let's have another question.
Hi, it's Carl here. Love the cycling podcast. I wanted to ask you a bit of a technical question. Looking back at all the years you've been doing the podcast, I've been listening to them for a few years now, back to maybe 2014. Difficult question here. I hope you can answer it honestly, but what's the best restaurant you've eaten at? What did you have? And which wine did you have with it? I'd be really interested to know that answer.
Well, Carl, that's a great question and a very difficult one to answer, especially, I would think, for Francois, who, I mean, I don't want to, you know, reveal your age or anything, Francois, but if you were to add up the number of meals you've had on the tour, that's a lot of food, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a lot of food because I, you know, well, nearly 30 tours, and so that's about, well, 20, well, let's even put it down to 20 days, it's what, 600 days, so 600 different restaurants. Not always different, but some of them.
Do you have a best? Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for me, actually, it's a very simple question to answer because there's a place that actually we discovered on Tour de France in the late 90s or very early noughties. And that's called Le Viscos, and it's in a little village in the Pyrenees called Saint-Savin. Great place with a little abbatial church and near Argelès-Gazost, very close to Argelès-Gazost, not far from Lourdes. And one day we were going down from the Tourmalet late, as we always often do, thinking we were not going to have dinner. I mean, this is one of the big scares of covering the tour. And we had a friend, Thierry Cazeneuve, who was actually the guy in charge of the Dauphiné race, and he was a gourmet, to say the least. And he said, "Well, listen, guys, I've spotted this little restaurant not far from here, down the Tourmalet, in the Michelin guide, because at the time no internet or very little internet." And so he said, "We're going down now." He was being driven by Charlie Motte at the time, and we booked a table for six, and join us there. And it was an incredible discovery. The food is absolutely excellent. The staff are so very nice, and it's become quite of with time. It's become quite a kind of a rendezvous for cyclists and tour lovers. I mean, one of the guy who owns it, Jean-Pierre Saint-Martin, is he has the bulk of Greipel a little bit more. So I mean, he's got a collection of chins as well. So I mean, which is quite comforting when you go to a restaurant. But one of his sons is a keen rider. So I mean, and lots of cyclists go there even in the off season because it's down from the Tourmalet. The food is just absolutely astounding. The first thing we had was, and it's still one of the place's favorite dishes. It's been passed on from generation to generation. It's an apple, you know, baked in the oven, and it's stuffed with black pudding from the local, you know, pork, and foie gras. And this is absolutely unbelievable. Another thing is called tastou. I don't exactly know what's in there, but it's pork and a little bit of duck. It's very, very, very high cholesterol stuff, but it's absolutely amazing. They've got lots of this, and they also, the new chef, who is the son of Jean-Pierre Saint-Martin, Alexis, he's a specialist of, a piece of pork called presse de porc that is very, very tender, and you eat it rare. So, as you can see, not much room for, low cholesterol or vegetarianism. But don't get me wrong. I mean, they do stuff. They really like the veggies. No problem at all. You can have they are so, ever so nice. It's, you know, it's really a great place. And the good thing is we'll be, you know, kind of ending the tour this year at Le Viscos, because the other guys from the podcast don't know this place, and I'm sure they'll become, you know, members of the ride.
And we have two nights there.
We have two nights
there. Wow. Yeah. Wow. I think the joy for me has been, over the years, the unexpected meal that suddenly comes out of nowhere when you're fearing the worst. And we had exactly that experience up in the Vendée on a Sunday evening, everywhere.
Monday evening, wasn't it?
It was Monday evening. Because on the Sunday, we'd eaten in a little pizzeria, creperie. Mm-hmm. Well, I had a pizza. You guys had a crepe, I think. And we really just sort of ducked under Indiana Jones style. We managed to get in rolled under to get in, and they guaranteed they'd serve us. But it was a very late meal and quite a long wait. On the Monday, I think they were pretty scarred by that Sunday night, and they were closed on the Monday. And we were in a remote area, and there was nothing around. And we were looking on TripAdvisor, and Francois tried a couple of restaurants. Nothing doing. We ended up at a pizza machine.
We were driving from village to village, and the villages were just closed. There was
everything was
nothing
closed.
Going on.
Yeah, we found a pizza hut.
But we didn't know we were going to end up at a pizza machine. We were following a TripAdvisor rated. Mm. This is the problem with TripAdvisor. Pizzeria.
And
the pizzeria was a machine.
It was a shed, like a garden, a big luxury garden shed with a pizza oven in it. And you put your money in or your card in, and then you get a pizza out in 3 minutes. Now, Francois got out of the car quite excited about this, thinking, well, let's see what it's like. Came back to the car. I think these are pretty good. Let's try them. But in the meantime, we'd also found a restaurant another maybe 15 minutes away, and it was called Le Quilbus, and it was in Clisson. And honestly, I mean, it was probably the meal of the tour so far.
It's so funny though, driving there, because remember the road was closed.
That's
so
right.
It's 15 minutes away, and we're barreling along the road, and we come to a big, in the middle of nowhere, there's nothing going on, there's nothing there, and there's a barrier down saying road closed. Obviously, we took Francois' advice on that, and we ignored the sign, and we drove on, and we got there, and wow, was it worth it?
It
was really enjoyable as well, because we had, I mean, we'd sort of.
But this place was run by young people. Mm-hmm. It was the interior decoration had been thought about clearly. The menu was quite short, but you know, maybe three starters, three main courses, three desserts.
Most of the stuff was organic. The wine list was very clever. I mean, they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, and I had a cold vegetable soup, which was absolutely hit the spot after a hot day, followed by a loin of pork that was cooked rare. Absolutely delicious.
Le Quilbus.
But it's a cliche now that my fondness for cassoulet, which stems back to my childhood, really. I ate cassoulet cooked by my dad well before I'd ever had it in France. We're in Carcassonne now, and had a good 8 out of 10 cassoulet last night. Possibly have another one this evening. But I enjoy the kind of, if I'm in the Alps, I do like to have raclette or tartiflette. The controversy over the Bourg-en-Bresse chicken still rages. But the first time I ever had this was a real sensation. I mean, it's in the Hotel de France in Bourg-en-Bresse, where ASO always stay. So you know, you think, well, the food here will be pretty good, and you get this sort of big corn-fed chicken leg, very yellow flesh with a lovely gravy and mashed potato, and it's really good. And I raved about this, but it is expensive. And we went once, and I think we got the sort of the, they gave it, we were sort of top of 10 when we got there, and they gave us the very small leftover chicken legs, and I got a lot of flack for that.
You were fuming.
I was fuming.
Anyway, we should wrap things up. My mouth's watering now, and it's almost time for dinner. Thank you very much, Francois.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.